behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. You are you. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Dylan, nicknamed to be assigned, Fagan, and, of course, Noel, the Madman Brown. Scott, today we're talking about one of, I don't know how you feel about this, but we're talking about one of my favorite things.
What is it?
Land yachts.
Oh,
man.
Yeah, the giant vehicles, right? Huge vehicles. And it encompasses a larger portion of the 20th century than I thought it did initially. I don't know why I hadn't cast my mind back far enough in this one, but we're talking about a group of vehicles that can be lumped into this that start in about the 1920s and go all the way through the 1970s. For some reason, I just have it stuck in my head that the true land yachts come from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah.
But I just completely had forgotten how large some of those older cars could be, like the old Duesenbergs.
I knew you were going to say Duesenbergs.
Yeah.
They're massive and monstrous. And part of that, you know, of course, is miniaturization techniques that evolved over the decades. You know, just back in the 20s, if you wanted a certain amount of power, the engine was just going to have to be that large and that long.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll get to power, by the way, because that's an interesting part of this whole tale. And we should get this out of the way right up front here. It's this comes from a listener suggestion.
Yes, yes, yes.
Our good friend Rudy Smith wrote in and said that he writes in with so many topics that we have a hard time covering everything that he writes in for.
Now,
sometimes I include it in a Facebook post or something because these are fantastic ideas.
He's our correspondent.
He is. You know, there's a few people that write in that we take a lot of their ideas, like a high percentage of their ideas.
There's
a few of those listeners that are like that. But Rudy is definitely one. He's got some good ones. And here's the note. It says, Scott and Ben, after seeing a mammoth Lincoln premiere at Old Car City, which, by the way, is about an hour from here.
We should totally go.
We really should.
He's
been there and we haven't been there.
Man.
What does that say?
He's our correspondent.
He's dedicated.
So that's part of it.
Dedicated to the cause. So after seeing a mammoth Lincoln premiere at Old Car City, I was inspired to think of land yachts. I think it might make a good show topic. How long were they? How much did they weigh? How are they different from cars of the era that were not considered land yachts? How do they compare in size with today's cars? He said to see some of them, it looks like there was like an arms race to see who could make the most gigantic luxury car. The term conspicuous consumption comes to mind. And then he lists a huge list of links. And this helped us in choosing this topic, I'll tell you that, because a lot of the research was already done. It's already out there. So,
hey, spoilers, Scott.
Yeah, well, if you provide a link, that helps a lot because then we know where to begin, right?
Right, and right. That is true.
This is a good beginning. There must be 20 links here, but he's talking about hoods and fins and ridiculous luxury features and, of course, big V8 engines, you know, miles per gallon, if that's a thing, really.
Oof.
More like gallons per mile.
Yeah.
And some examples. And then, of course, you know, the question over the longest ever U.S. production vehicle made. And we'll have an answer for that at the very end, I promise.
We do. Okay, we'll save it for the very end.
Well, somewhere near the end, maybe. But maybe what we should do is describe kind of what a land yacht might be so that people understand, because there's a couple of things that have that similar moniker.
Yes. Okay, that's perfect, because some people will tell you that a land yacht is an umbrella term for RVs, recreational vehicles.
Kind of makes sense.
That makes sense. But that's not what we're talking about today. One of the, for some people, a land yacht or a lead sled or a yank tank, for our Australian friends out there, and watch me pronounce it correctly, Melbourne and Brisbane.
Nice work.
Did I do that? I think I messed up the other one.
I think you got it right, but that's a new term for me, by the way.
Melbourne, I got.
Well, not those terms. I mean, I don't mean those. I mean the yank tank. It makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, right? that's apparently Australian slang for what we would consider land yachts, but also for SUVs. And sometimes, like growing up, I would think a land yacht, I know it when I see it, you know, I would feel like I would be able to, if not articulate a solid definition, you know, like based on time periods, that I could definitely see something and go give it a hard yes or no.
I think 99% of our audience is that way. And I think it's kind of like, you know, the definition of other things where you say, I can't describe it, but I know it when I see it.
Right, right. Or if someone's, and you know, there will be other people with a more narrow or a strict definition.
Yeah, like right? A focus direction. Like it has to be this length. The wheelbase has to be this. It has to be created within this time frame.
Like muscle cars and pony cars.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a long history of land yachts, and we've got this list of about 50 modern vehicles. We'll not go through the whole list, but there are some surprises on the list that I thought we should bring up in this podcast. So we'll get to that at some point, I promise.
Yes, and as we proceed, we'll say that one of the most common definitions that I keep finding that pops up is the idea, this comes also from a Jalopnik article, that land yachts describe the largest full-size cars made by U.S. and German automakers from the 50s to the 90s. I don't agree with that definition because I think, you know, I think it does go back further. I think the 20s, we see, like, you read my mind about the Duesenberg stuff, but up to the 90s, I mean, I'll be honest with you, man, I was driving some cars when I was a kid that I thought, these are land yachts.
Well, sure. Yeah, you're talking about the big Bonnevilles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, those were. To me, those are big land yachts as well because they were making other cars at the time that were a lot smaller. So mm-hmm. This was the top-end vehicles for the manufacturer. You know, they had the most luxury features.
Yeah.
They were the softest ride. They were the most comfortable. They were the most expensive mm-hmm. also in a lot of cases because they could cram everything they wanted on there, and size wasn't a consideration. Cost wasn't a consideration in a lot of cases. So, you know, they'd have the biggest engines.
Yeah.
They had the characteristics. I guess of you know trying to motor through a docking area, you know trying to park in a parking lot. It's the same way, you know, the big long slow turns that you had to make.
Oh yeah, they're not nimble.
No, not in any way. And you know, I mean, I think most people probably have some kind of experience, whether it's you know with grandparents, you know, driving the Cadillac or you know the Bonneville like you had, or you know, friends in high school that had some giant old vehicle, you know, like a big Delta 88 or something. That
right.
It's like a couple of couches inside a moving vehicle.
Yeah.
You can drive around and you can bring as many friends as you want. You know, a lot of people have some really good experiences in these land yachts from the past. You know, like nostalgia mm-hmm. Is brought up, I guess, every time that you see or think of one of these. Man, where do we go with this? Because these are full size cars.
Mm-hmm.
The focus, I guess, was on soft ride and comfort and luxury.
Definitely.
So handling is not really anything to consider here.
No.
You would think they would have like the most powerful giant V8 engines that they could possibly cram in there, but the case was they put maybe the biggest V8 engines they could in there,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the most powerful that they had, as we'll find out.
Right, right. And then also, when we talk about power, you know, weight becomes a factor because these are heavier.
Yeah, weight was a huge factor in these vehicles, so they had to have these big V8 engines. But, you know, you think, well, this is really, again, as Rudy said, conspicuous consumption. But, you know, at the time, fuel economy wasn't a concern.
No, this is all pre-oil crisis.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the low gas prices, there's really no environmental concerns at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There probably were, but no one was really focused on it. It wasn't a regulation at the time that they had to meet. You know, there's just so much to this. Of course, there's the population itself that, you know, this was meant for.
Right.
Let's say the middle class, upper middle class, you know, that
sure.
are these big full-size luxury vehicles. Well, their prosperity, I guess, is increasing. You know, they're gainfully employed. They're making what they consider to be a lot of money at the time. They might as well use it to show off a little bit.
And it was, because if we're talking about what people would popularly describe as the heyday of these vehicles, then we're talking about post-World War II economic boom.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes into another important difference because we mentioned that some German manufacturers are considered to have made land yachts. It's true that other countries, other continents, other parts of the world with big manufacturing bases like Japan or European countries eventually made cars that would be larger or that size, but there's a design part of this, an aesthetic that ties into distinguishing American land yachts. So, for instance, they would have, you know, the white wall tires, body-on-frame construction, mm-hmm. Very, like you said, very heavily cushioned, roomy interior.
Yeah.
What I loved about the Bonneville is it's like I was inviting, you know, I'd be going on a date and I would say, hey, come with me to my rolling studio apartment.
That's about what it was. Yeah. Really, it was. I mean, they're long, low, and wide, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
That was the idea. Mm-hmm. It was, back from Harley Earl's, you know, thought process mm-hmm. back at GM in the day. And seriously, they're just, you can spot them on the road when you see them. That's one of those things that you just have to see it, and once you do, you understand exactly what it is. You don't think like, well, that could be just a compact sedan. It's definitely not a compact.
It's more of a land schooner.
Yeah. You know, I'm probably overthinking this whole thing. I mean, people understand exactly what a land yacht is. So we think about like big caddies and vehicles that were maybe even a little taller, a little bigger than they are today, because you know the thought process is now to get them kind of low into the lower of the ground, a little more aerodynamic, and mm-hmm. fuel efficiency is more of a concern now than it was. So there are examples of land yachts today that we'll get to that, again, there's some shockers on that list. There's some that you know about. And one thing that we should say is that we realize that there are pickup trucks and SUVs that are longer than the sedans of today. And of yesteryear, I guess. You know, they're longer than the old Cadillacs were
sure.
in some cases.
Especially if they got the extended cab, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, they got the crew cab and then the 8-foot bed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with the bumpers that stick out like swim platforms on the back end. And, you know, they're enormous trucks, but we're not counting trucks right now. We're talking mm-hmm. about production sedans mm-hmm. in the United States. And so one other quick thing, and this is the last, and I'll let you finally talk, Ben. One last thing is that you got to remember that this is cars that are in the pre-stretch limo phase. So you take a production vehicle, send it to an aftermarket coach builder and have them stretch mm-hmm. the frame and body, mm-hmm. and you can make a car that's, you know, 200 feet long
sure.
if you wanted to.
Yeah, just like a hearse or something.
Well, yeah, exactly. But we're talking about these were built by the manufacturers at this length. This is, you know, the wheelbase. This is the length.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are pretty impressive. Now, you know, I'm going to give it away if I say it too early. But,
yeah, don't. We've got to wait for that for a second.
I'll wait.
But I have a question for you, and before you answer it, we'll go to a word from our sponsor. But here's the question: this is for you, Scott. This is for you, Rudy. This is for everybody listening in the audience. Should a station wagon be considered a land yacht? We'll be right back with Scott's answer. And we're back. All right, Scott, we took some time during the ad break here, so hope that you feel like, even though I did a little bit of gotcha journalism, I hope you feel like you've had time to ponder this.
I'm comfortable with this.
Okay, all right.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, you think so?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're enormous vehicles, and they're factory built at that length, that size. They're huge, huge vehicles. We're talking about the ones that have, you know, 9-passenger carrying capabilities.
Right.
You know, the rearward facing back seats.
Those are the coolest part.
Yeah, I know. Those are some of the greatest, longest vehicles that you'll see on the road these days. I mean, they're really, really cool. And in fact, there's a couple of articles that I read that have kind of elevated these to what they call beautiful works of art, really. And they're right. They're absolutely right when they say that, you know, some of these older station wagons are among some of the best designed classic cars that are out there. They really are cool. And I know there's a faction of people that say that, you know, I just don't like even look at the body design of a wagon versus like a two-door coupe or something. That's way cooler to have a two-door coupe than a four-door station wagon that can seat 9 people.
I see that. I can see that idea for sure, and that's an aesthetic thing. It all goes back to what you want from a particular vehicle. However, I notice that I'm finally getting old enough, man, where I can see the way things cycle through popular culture, mm-hmm. and in more than autos, but it applies to autos just as well. And I got to tell you, it's kind of creepy. I finally get what my parents were talking about, but I think that the old school station wagons are due for a pretty big spike or resurgence, because a lot of people who would have bought a station wagon, you know, in the past few years are buying like crossovers. You know what I mean? They're getting like Pacificas and stuff.
Yeah. So it's coming back down to smaller again.
Yeah. And so I think people will eventually, if for nothing more than nostalgia, start really liking station wagons.
Well, okay. So this may be a stretch, but think about like the Porsche Panamerica.
All right.
Stretching out a Porsche design, a coupe design into a sedan.
Yeah.
And then where it's just kind of a short step from there to wagon body, right?
True.
And they also make SUVs. I understand they make, the sporty SUVs. There's other manufacturers that have been doing this all along. Cadillac still makes station wagons.
Mm-hmm.
Volvo, of course, still makes station wagons. Chrysler for a while had its Magnum that was really cool. That was a throwback, I guess.
Yeah.
An interesting design. I like that a lot. It's gone now. They don't make it anymore. I think you're right. I think that people are going to move back to station wagons at some point. I think it's going to come back with full force, really, because what you can do with that much real estate,
for the
designers must, you know what, I'm going to say I would guess that designers would really like to design wagons again.
Oh, yeah.
I would think.
I would think so. And then additionally, just from a customization standpoint, there's a lot of stuff that you could do as a car owner in the interior. I don't want to get into accidentally derail us into a station wagon podcast, but I'm glad that you had that answer. Some people would say that it only applies to that a station wagon is too different to a sedan for it to apply.
Mm-hmm.
But
Four doors.
Still has four wheels.
Still
just
built
more seats.
Built from the manufacturer, right off the assembly line, just like that. It's not a custom coach built vehicle. You don't send it out somewhere. They haven't made it into a wagon.
It's a sedan with a bigger butt.
Yeah, I guess you're right. And a lot of times you'll notice that some of these older vehicles, they look just like the sedan or the coupe version of the car with just that station wagon back end over it. The open back end instead of the trunk. And that was the case with almost all of those, is that, they matched the same wheelbase.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a longer overhang at the back end, or they had, a dramatically different roof line. But it was basically the same car for the front three quarters. And then the back quarter was what's new, I guess.
So this author, Louis Quinteros from Jalopnik, agrees with you, because one of the first things on his list of the 10 great land yachts is the 1991 Chevrolet Capri wagon.
Wait, 1991?
Yeah. He went into the 90s. The
Buick
Roadmaster.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, the huge.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
Oldsmobile custom cruiser.
Yeah.
So, it's the Buick Roadmaster's return, right?
Oh, yeah.
But then, of course, that's not in production. And the author says that's largely due to SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that definition checks out with you, so I don't have to write them a strongly worded letter.
A very terse note back to them.
A very terse note.
Yes.
To whom it may concern. The other one that I wanted to ask you about, and if you're cool with it, do you want to trade back and forth some examples?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The other one that I wanted to ask you about is Mercedes-Benz 600, 1965.
Hmm.
So this is German, of course, 18 feet long, 5,700 pounds. And so...
Wait. What's the name of the vehicle again? It's a...
The Mercedes-Benz 600.
600, okay. Oh, I know what you're talking about. This is the dictator's car.
Yeah, it's the dictator's car.
Yeah, it seems like everybody... doesn't it seem that way?
Yes, it does. this is, Jeremy Clarkson doofed around with one of these on Top Gear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because for me, before we were doing some research for this show or for this episode, I had always just thought of land yachts as a very American thing, and I was a little, it makes sense because it fits the definition. Like you said, four doors, no aftermarket stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just got a really long length. It's kind of low. It's heavy. It's not nimble.
No, not in any way. Well, yeah, I know we're going back and forth with a couple of examples here, but I just want to point out that there were so many examples that, like my friend in high school, or friends, I should say, one had a Delta 88, the other one had a Vista Cruiser, a station wagon, like on that 70s show, the kind that had the little window at the top.
Uh-huh.
It was used as, his parents owned a hardware store, and they used it kind of as like the hauler, I guess, for stuff they needed back and forth between home and there. And that was a cool car. That was a lot of fun. And then, another friend drove full-size Chevy Caprice, not station wagons, but full-size, big sedans, I guess, that were really boxy, really squared off, had huge engines in them. That's the same friend that had the Vista Cruiser, by the way. But yeah, there were people there that had some enormous vehicles, and you know, it was a lot of fun to hang out in those things. And there were other examples from, you know, more prestigious manufacturers. And oh, you know what? I gotta say this before I even forget.
Yeah, yeah.
There was another friend in high school that had a Checker cab.
What?
And, yeah, he had a Checker cab.
How?
At the end of it was someone I knew through a friend, so I didn't get a ride in it a lot. But he had bought an old decommissioned Checker cab, and it was a gray vehicle, almost like a primer gray. It wasn't yellow at the time. Had I-beams for bumpers. That's how heavy-duty this thing was.
Oh, wow.
And when you got in the back seat, you know, there's like 3 feet of room between your knees and the back seat.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the back of the front seat, I should say. An enormous vehicle, but it was a huge, fun car to be in. You know,
did he have the plate up? The glass plate?
No, I didn't have that.
It's a different time.
No, this was all open inside, but there was just a ton of space inside of it.
That's crazy, man.
The other prestigious ones we're talking about are, like, you know, of course we mentioned Cadillac and Lincoln and Buick and, you know, other I guess, American brands that had large-size sedans could also have, you know, I guess they are sedans. They're big full-size versions of these things that were full of luxury features. So, you know, one that kind of gets overlooked here, and it's one of the this is an author from My Classic Garage who wrote an article about some of the longest American cars from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
This author brings up one of his favorite examples, and it's the 1966 Oldsmobile Toronado. And this one gets overlooked a lot.
Huh.
Because, it's just not what you typically consider as a land yet. I think this was a front-wheel drive car to begin with. That's something unusual, different. The production run began in 1966. They had a huge wheelbase for a two-door coupe. You got to consider that it's two doors, so it has this real long look anyways. The wheelbase was 119 inches and a total length of 211 inches. So that's a pretty long vehicle. We're talking about ballpark, I'm going to guess. I don't have the calculator in front of me here, but that's about 18 feet, maybe a few inches less than 18 feet. So it's a big vehicle. But that's the kind of size you're talking about for a lot of vehicles that were on the road in that time or that era. Other specifics, I guess, you can talk about the Continentals. Continentals. They had enormous V8 engines. Those are a popular choice among people looking for old, I guess maybe old hot rods to, you know, restore.
Right,
and
right.
I don't know if you call a Lincoln hot rod to begin with, but a lot of people have turned them into hot rods because of, the engine and transmission combinations that they had, along with these really cool slab side looks.
Yeah.
So they get turned into something that they weren't meant to be originally. But others like to just, you know, completely restore it.
You sound a little conservative about that.
I mean, honestly, go back and, go back and look at just about any vehicle. You can look up specs for any vehicle, right? So if you type in 1960, let's make something up, Mercury coupe specs.
Mm-hmm.
Or sedan specs or whatever, you're going to find that, you know, these wheelbases are in the the overall lengths are going to be in the 18-foot range for just about everything that they made. And
yeah,
that's just one example. You could do that for almost any vehicle, really, of that era, unless it was, you know, purposely like a sports car or a sedan, or a hatchback or something that was meant to be small.
It was more like that longer length and the wider frame in general was just more mainstream. It was closer to what was considered normal.
It was common.
Yeah, it was common. That's the perfect word. And what we see there, too, is in some ways the status symbol part of it. Because, you know, yes, you're buying the family's first car, right? It's 1950-something. Mm-hmm. And you've been talking to the dealer, right? And unfortunately for you, this is before car stuff existed, so you don't have, you know, you don't have tips and tricks on how to buy cars.
It's a few years before us.
A little bit. And you want to get something that makes an impression. You want to be able to haul the kids around and haul stuff. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want, at the time, like, your neighbors to come up to you and say, like, oh, Bill, is that even a car? Tiny thing?
Yeah, did you lose your job, Bill?
Yeah. Did you? I mean, I've never seen a covered go-kart.
Okay. But here's the thing, though. Like, you go into a showroom in that era, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything you see is going to be big compared to now, really.
Yes, and there's an important reason for that.
Okay, what's that?
Well, I think we mentioned it a little bit earlier, is that beginning with the oil crises in the 1970s, the sort of hierarchy of desires from a car changed fundamentally, even for people who ordinarily would never worry about that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So even if you were, you know, stepping into, let's say, a Dodge Dart or something like
right.
that, now that's not a huge car from that era, but it's big compared to a lot of the sedans that we see today, or not maybe not sedans, but maybe maybe some of the two-door coupes that are a little bit on the smaller side now. So it's all perspective. It's all in it's relative, I guess. Maybe that's a better mm-hmm. way to say it. It's relative.
So I've got an idea. With some of the pros and cons that we've outlined so far, we've talked about, you know, one of the pros, spacious, luxurious, very smooth down the river kind of ride.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cons would be, of course, the handling is just piss poor. Can I say that on the air?
I think you just did.
Oh, okay.
Fair enough.
All right. Sorry. Any children or parents listening
again,
to the show?
PG-13. What's happening? We're slipping.
We're slipping. Do I need to take it out?
No. Leave it.
All right. Okay. So the handling is rough. The fuel efficiency is rough. But one thing we didn't talk about in detail was the engine. The engine work, the engine specs.
Yeah, I guess. And what we saw is a lot of, I guess we'll call them truck-size engines in cars mm-hmm. of the day. And the thing of, here's the situation with them, though. They're not quite the powerhouses that we see today. You know, they weren't uh-huh. Extremely, well, some, okay, I'm going to back this up a little bit. I was going to say they weren't high compression real monsters, but there were versions of them that were that were stuffed mm-hmm. into, you know, smaller body vehicles, you know, muscle cars, of course.
Right.
But these engines that powered some of these great big sedans, some of these big luxury barges, I guess,
yeah.
that, you know, were on the road, or Luxo barges, that was the word
That's
I was looking
the
for. Yeah, they were giant, they were enormous engines, but they were relatively underpowered. So, you know, they had the two barrel carbs on them instead of the four barrel, or, Ooh. You know, I guess this all depends on how you ordered them, but they were paired with, you know, a 3-speed automatic transmission that wasn't the fastest shifting automatic that you could get. It wasn't the manual transmission, of course,
mm-hmm.
You know, for a little sportier feel. The gearing wasn't exactly the same. So, you know, there was a lot of, I wouldn't call it strikes against these engines, but they were enormous V8s that weighed just, they weighed so much, and
yeah.
they put them in the front of these things for the, you know, the giant rear-wheel drive platforms that they mm-hmm. That they often came with, and you would be surprised by some of the low numbers that came out of these enormous engines. So there are some that, you know, again, exceptions to all this. So
sure.
I found a list of eight of the biggest V8 engines that Detroit ever sold in a car. Now, the problem with the list is that some of these are also the most powerful engines that, you know, they were also stuffed into some of these, you know, you could order them in the big luxury cars.
Right.
But they mostly came in the sports cars. The reason that I was intrigued by this article is because it ends with one of the engines that we're going to talk about in the longest production car that we're going to get to at the very end of this podcast. So you see my dilemma here. I can't really even read you number one out of this list yet because I want to wait for the reveal at the end.
Well, let's get up to number two. And then we'll have a little bit of a cliffhanger.
All right. So starting here at number eight, the Chrysler 440. That is the 440. That's a huge engine to
yeah.
start with at number
yeah.
eight on the list. But you know, they sold performance versions of this with the TNT version for some of their sportier cars, I guess. But they also sold kind of a modest version, I guess, of the 440. Big block, of course, that was for, you know, some of the other vehicles that were more family oriented, I guess, maybe, that, you know, didn't have quite the output of the ones that were, I guess, geared more towards the sporty buyer.
I'm probably
overstating all this, but as you could guess, performance started out really high back in 1965 when they first launched this thing, and by 1978 it had dropped all the way down. So, and the reason was because of emission regulations. So, starting out, you know, like at 375 horsepower, and you know, around 1967-68, they could even produce more than that. It was almost up to 400 horsepower if you had two three-barrel carburetors on it, you know, with the six-pack version or a 440 six-barrel for Plymouth as well. The six-pack, by the way, is for Dodge. I should have mentioned that. But the point is that, you know, these could be kind of hopped up, I guess, to make mm-hmm. make a better version of them. But in 1972, all of these engines that we're going to talk about, everyone across the board was really pared down. Because they lowered the compression ratio for a lot of them, they had more conservative cam timing for a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
and of course other changes to comply with these stricter emissions controls that came into place. And of course, You know, the 440 was one that suffered, so it dropped down to like 335 horsepower around 1972. And then, you know, if you want, that was just gross horsepower. You want to talk about like the SAE net horsepower, the net horsepower rating?
Yeah.
It was all the way down to 225 at that point.
From like 390, right?
Yeah, 390 down to that, or 375, let's say.
Okay.
And then even more in 1978, it dropped all the way down to 255. And at that point, they only allowed it to be used in, you know, police car applications or maybe, you know, taxis or something like that.
Oh,
so
wow.
All of the engines that we're going to talk about dropped in power or output like that. And it's not necessarily that they were producing less. It was just they were choked even more. Or, you know, fuel economy became more of a concern. And these are the engines that they were stuffing in some of these bigger cars.
And this is across the board?
Again, yeah, that's right. They were across the board. All U.S. manufacturers had to deal with the same type of thing. So, you know, that's just one example. But some other engines that were thrown into both sports cars and sedans.
Yeah.
There was a three-way tie for number five, the Pontiac 455, the Oldsmobile 455,
yeah,
and then the Buick 455. And those are all different engines. They've all got their own specs and data that you can look through. And number four on the list is the Lincoln 460, which you might have already guessed. But then number three would be the Lincoln 462. And, you know, you would think that that's such a small distinction there, you know, up to, you know, 2 cubic inches, what's the big difference? It's completely different engines.
It's a different architecture.
It warrants its own, you know, a place on the list, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a modern version for number, or modern engine rather, for number two, and it's kind of the bringing back of the old big block Chevy engine, and this is the Vortec 8100. And essentially, this is the 454 big block that has been increased or upped to about 496 cubic inches by, you know, increasing the stroke on the thing. So, again, that's a modern version. And the number one engine on this list is the one that I can't tell you about because that's one we're going to talk about with the largest or the longest production car that the U.S. ever produced. That was a long list, but you know what? If you dig into it, there's a lot of detail from there's a site called gearheads.org that I went to for that, and you can read all about it, and you can argue with you know, the specs and stats that are on that site.
And one thing I will say to put some fuel on the fire here for the land yacht purist is that that modern engine you mentioned, the Vortec, is used for Chevy and GMC trucks, vans, and Suburbans.
Yeah, but the reason that they included it on this list, and you would think that why is it on the car list, is because those vehicles can use car license plates.
So
the,
that's the one
reason that it qualified for this list, the rules, I guess, that the author put together for this list. It can use passenger car plates. And so the idea is that, you know, this thing kind of resembles, I guess, the old 454 big block, but it's upped a little bit.
I think we've added our gasoline to the fire now for the argument. So,
yeah.
What is number one? What is the mystery we've been teasing for this episode? We'll be back with the answer after a word from our sponsor. Oh, and we're back. That was a rough intro to our ad.
You almost forgot what we were talking about, man.
I know.
On to the next show.
Oh man. Whoa, any segue you can walk away from, right?
That's exactly right.
But let's not keep the people waiting any longer. I'd like to ask for a drum roll from our super producer, Dylan. Scott Benjamin, what is the largest of the land yachts?
The 1974 to 1976 Cadillac Fleetwood 75.
And it's huge.
It's huge. That's right, yeah. And it's a giant vehicle. It's 21 feet in length. That's incredible. It's 252.2 inches overall. If you want to get the what you'll read in the papers, I guess. No one reads papers anymore. That's what you're going to find on all the auto blogs. The wheelbase of this thing is 151.5 inches. So that means that, you know, from wheel center to wheel center, you know, on this vehicle, you're talking about 12.5 feet between the wheels. That's a huge car. Try to picture that in your garage the next time you go home. There are photos of this online of one that was, I guess, kind of spotted in the wild, right?
Yeah.
And I think the one that they saw was in 1973, which is 2 inches shorter than the 1974 through 1976 version. And it's longer than the box truck that is parked next to. That gives you an idea of how big this thing is. So most modern garages will not fit this vehicle. It's too long. I got a house. My house was built in 1994, I think it was.
Okay, so you have a modern house.
I was going to say maybe not even modern. It's an older house, really. I mean, 1994. What is it? 23 years old now at this point.
Oh yeah, no, it just hit me.
Time to trash that place. Trying to move on. No, I'm just kidding. It's a relatively newer place.
But,
my house in Michigan was built in 55, and it had a nice deep garage, and there was a reason for that. Mm-hmm. It's because they had these giant vehicles. So you needed that extra length to be able to park in there. Well, when I brought my latest car home, my project car, this is years ago now, mm-hmm. I did some careful measuring to make sure that it wouldn't stick out of the back end. I'd be able to close the garage door behind it.
Yeah.
There'd be no way with this one. I have a total of 19 feet of length in my garage. If you touch the front wall, and that's where the garage door closes to. So, you know, let's say I have 18 feet 11 inches to play with in the garage, and that's it. And it nearly takes up that for my Chrysler, but this Caddy would stick almost 3 feet. Well, I guess it'd be 2 feet out of the back end of that thing. It wouldn't be able to close the garage. So that would be a problem for a lot of people. The weight of this thing, this behemoth, is nearly 6,000 pounds. It's like 20 pounds shy of 6,000 pounds. So it's a 3-ton car that's on the road. And again, I want to make this clear. What we're talking about here is it's a limo body. And you may think that disqualifies it from our list because it's a limo, but this is a factory-built limo. It wasn't a limo that they sent out for production, you know, again, to a custom coach builder. This is something that GM built on the assembly line. And therefore, it qualifies as, you know, one of these the largest vehicles ever. They sold thousands of these. They sold something like, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 every year, and they really weren't terribly expensive. They were about $12,000 around that, you know, ballpark. And I know that when you start loading it with features and you know, extras and add-ons, it gets to be quite a bit more. But ballpark $12,000 at the time, and that's if you want to adjust that for now.
Yeah,
it's right around $60,000. You know, again, ballpark.
Yeah.
Still expensive.
60 grand.
But you're getting a Cadillac limo.
Yeah.
For 60 grand. Yeah.
I mean, if 60 grand is too rich for your blood, what are you doing in the limo game?
and you know, we mentioned, you know, that Cadillac continued to build limos for a long time after this. It's just that they sent them out to these custom coach builders. And that happened right around, again, no coincidence here, right around 1977 when they started to shorten the Cadillac. They started to downsize Caddy. Mm-hmm. And so from 77 until about, I want to say, it's testing the lengths of my memory here, the depths of my memory, Ben. I want to say 87 is when they stopped building.
Fleetwood program entirely?
They stopped shipping Cadillacs out from the factory to be stretched into limousine form.
Oh.
So that kind of shut down the whole process right around 1987.
Yeah.
Okay, now we need to get to the engine. These are enormous cars. I mean, is there more that you want to say about the interior of them? Because they're impressive.
I think you've got it, man.
Yeah, they're big. They're big cars. They have things like, what's funny is the one that we're looking at here in this this photograph has a TV antenna in back. It looks kind of like the tail of a jet. You know what I'm talking about? Like a big Boss Hog style Caddy with these just weird looking antenna thing on the back. It's nothing like the modern antennas. The engines. Okay.
The engines.
These are the big engines. Now these are, I guess you could call them, I hate to say this because this is a, you know, superlative, I guess, the world's largest production V8 engines that power sedans. And I hate it. Now, I know that someone will contest this. You know,
there's like, some caveats, but I think you're pretty accurate because we say that again so everybody can walk through it. The world's largest V8 engines powering production sedans.
Yeah, okay, so there's a lot of caveats, and again, from the factory, so I know that people stuff larger engines in there,
etc.
We, you know, modifications aside, you know, these giant Cadillac engines, now up until 1968, they used a 429 V8. It's a big engine, right? Not too small, but by 1968, I believe it was that I meant just said, they had already been surpassed by, like, the Chrysler 440 or Lincoln's 460 and 462 engine that they had now that we mentioned just a moment ago. So they upped it to about 472 cubic inches. And, again, this displacement, you know, 7.73 liters, it's a huge, huge engine. But there was a possibility of upping this design up to a 600. If you board and stroke this engine, it could have a potential of being a 600 cubic inch displacement engine from the same block. So, again, same... Well, anyways, you get the idea.
Yeah.
It had 375 horsepower, 525 pound-feet of torque at just 3,000 revolutions per minute. So this thing is only like 80 pounds heavier than than the old 429 that it replaced. Mm-hmm. And this was the one that was used through 1974. But by then, in 1970, they already had another optional engine available, and that was the 500 cubic inch engine from Cadillac.
Wow.
Now, it sounds really impressive, right? But,
right.
So we do need to step back a couple of years here, though, because in 1970, Cadillac fitted a crankshaft with a longer stroke on this engine block and, you know, achieved, as we said before, it had a potential for 600 cubic inches. They've now upped it to 500 cubic inches from the factory. So you can get a 500 cubic inch engine, an 8.2 liter from the factory. The horsepower output was, was about 400 horsepower and 550 pound-feet of torque. So that's pretty strong.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
but
again,
massive car, 6,000 pound car. Now, keep that in mind when you realize that in 1971, they reduced compression from 10.1 to 8.5 to 1, and the lower compression ratio dropped the 500's output from about 400 horsepower to about 365 horsepower. I guess if you want to look at the SAE ratings that we mentioned before, you know, with all the add-ons and, you know, emissions restrictions, et cetera, it's down to like 235 horsepower at this point. And that's not the bottom end, because in 1976, the final year, all of the stuff combined, you know, everything that they kept adding on and piling on with the regulations and restrictions.
Safety stuff, yeah.
This 500 cubic inch engine in 1976 had something like 190 horsepower, down to 190. From 400, you know, when it was launched in 1970. So just 6 years, and they shut it down. Now, there was an aftermarket, there's a different type of electronic fuel injection system that you could get as an option, and that increased the power output to about 215. But again, that's half of what it was when it was launched in 1970. So you can see where these restrictions really cut into, the performance of the vehicle.
Right.
And the performance is another thing that I should mention here. Oh, man, there's so much to cover in this episode. On the 1974 Cadillac Fleetwood 75.
Yeah, astonish me with these stats. Yeah,
well, 10.2 miles per gallon was about what you could expect, right?
Wow.
And that was probably really, you know, that's kind of probably geared a little bit towards fuel economy at that point, you know, because that's the era that we were going through. So a little bit towards that, not as much towards performance. So it's somewhere in between, it's still drivable in the street.
It's transitioning.
Yeah, so 10.2 miles per gallon is what you could expect out of this particular vehicle. 0 to 60 time was 12.6 seconds. I don't know.
How do you get on the highway?
Well, that's the thing. You got to get a good running start at it, I guess. And then once you get on the highway, the top speed was only 109 miles per hour. Not that you're going to want to take, you know, a car that's 21 feet long and 6,000 pounds up to 109 miles per hour, but maybe you would. Who knows?
Not like the salt flats or something?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it depends on how many bodies you got in the trunk, because that trunk was like an 8-body trunk, you know?
Yeah.
It's a big one.
That's back from when they used to rate land yachts by how many bodies you could fit in the trunk.
Yeah, I'm talking about drive-in movies, of course.
You're right.
Sneaking into the drive-in.
Oh.
What were you talking about?
The same thing?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you were.
This was also, interestingly enough, this engine family was the last of Cadillac's cast iron engines.
Yeah, the great big V8s, the big blocks, I guess.
Yeah, the big blocks.
Big block caddies, really.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's one more thing that we need to cover here that we've neglected.
Right, which is that although the Fleetwood holds the current title, fear not, the era of land yachts, while diminished, continues in the modern day.
Yeah, there's this constant fluctuation between sizes of vehicles. We notice that now they're kind of getting bigger, right? Cars are starting to get bigger.
Yeah.
So like, we've talked about this. The Mini's getting a little bit bigger. Sedans are starting to get a little longer, a little wider, a little lower again.
Actually, because I have to be honest, man, if I recall correctly, when we talked about, you know, the cycle of cars shrinking and expanding, I was the one complaining about the Mini, and I remember ranting, you know, like, don't call it a Mini,
Yeah.
If you keep making it bigger.
That's right. Look at some of the Fiats that they make now. You know, the Chrysler Fiats or Fiat Chryslers that are on the street now. Some of those are really big cars. I mean, they're great big hatchback. Well, anyways, getting off track here. Let's talk about this list that I pulled from a blog site called 0 to 60 Times. And it's funny. They completely ignore the classic vehicles here. This is more of a modern list, I guess. The largest cars in the world. And I think the point of this list is that it's current production. And again, excluding SUVs and, you know, the big trucks and stuff. We know there are bigger vehicles than that.
Right.
I'm just going to hit you with the number one vehicle, the longest one.
All right.
I don't think it'll surprise anybody, but it's a Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce car. It makes sense, right?
Yeah, I'm
okay,
not surprised.
Well, you'd think that Cadillac or Rolls-Royce or something would still be up there. Maybe even Lincoln. But it's a 2013 Rolls-Royce Phantom Extended Wheelbase, which has a wheelbase of It has an overall length of 239.8 inches. That's just under 20 feet. So even so, the current largest car in the world is still a foot, a little more than a foot shorter than that Cadillac that we just talked about.
Yeah, man. Can you imagine parallel parking that thing?
You don't even know if you would attempt to parallel park that thing.
Yeah, you would just be like, I don't need to go to this place.
Yeah, where's the semi parking?
Right, exactly.
It's a, you know, place where you don't have to back up at all, ever.
Yeah, but I got to be honest, man. I wish that I had been alive in the time where that was the normal, you know, like those late 50s, early 60s, just cherry cars.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, that was one of the things that we had talked about briefly when we looked at the cars of Cuba in a podcast ages ago, where that would be that's like outside of a car show, that's the closest place to that sort of experience that we could find.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. With some of the old classics, the giant boats that drive around there. Now, this list, it includes 50 of the largest cars in the world, so I'm not going to read all these, I promise, but there are some surprises on this list.
Yeah?
A lot of these are separated by just, you know, like, you know, 0.1 of an inch, you know, so very, very small,
small difference.
Yeah, yeah. I guess a minimal difference between each one of these. So as we go up the list, you know, starting down at number 50, the 2013 Ferrari FF is on the list. That's the number 50 on the list with 193.2 inches overall length. Going up, some of the surprises. I'll just read the surprises because that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Number 41 on the list is the 2013 Toyota Avalon. Oh, by the way, this list is probably built in 2014, if I had to guess. There's no date on this. I'm guessing 2013, 2014, based on the you know, the years, the models that we'll see. Again, the Toyota Avalon comes in at number 41, so that gives you an idea of where we're headed here. Tesla, the 2013 Tesla Model S, comes in at number 37 on this list. Kind of shocking. I know it's a big car, but I didn't know it was among the biggest on the road right now. 37th on the list. So that's relatively high, right? It's getting up there. Number 24, the 2013 Dodge Charger. I wouldn't have guessed that. I don't know why I would not guess that. Number 19 on the list, so climbing up even higher, the 2014 Chevy Impala is on the list at 201.3 inches as an overall length. And here's the one that is probably the most surprising and the highest on the list out of the ones that are surprises, I guess. Number 15 on the list is the 2013 Ford Taurus.
Huh.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I mean, I see those on the road all the time. I would never guess that's the 15th longest road on the vehicle on the road in 2013 or 2014. I wouldn't guess that.
Holy smokes.
16.9 feet long. That's a long vehicle.
Dude, that's wild.
Yeah, almost 17 feet long for a Ford Taurus.
I guess I don't really know a land yacht when I see it.
Well, you know, it has a different appearance. It's maybe a little bit taller. You know,
it's got more of a
I don't know. I wouldn't say a road presence, but
I would say stance. It's got a different stance.
Yeah,
than a land
it does.
Yacht.
It does. Yeah, but I just thought that was a big surprise. You know, because if you go down this list, it's, you know, Rolls Royce, Bentley, Audi, Jaguar, Mercedes, all the luxury marks.
Yeah, yeah.
And then number 15 is the Ford Taurus.
Ford Taurus.
Yeah.
And the Charger, I think of more as a performance car. You know?
I guess. I think it evolved into that over the years. Now, this is 2013 list. That's 4 years ago. Back then, it was a slightly different animal back then.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So, with this, we want to thank you again, Rudy, for the excellent suggestion. And I wanted to ask you this, Scott. Do you think we'll see a continuing trend of larger and larger vehicles?
I feel that we will. Yeah, I think that the Lincoln brand is coming back strong with some of these big luxury vehicles that people wanted back, you know, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to continue to build big sedans that become more and more luxurious and longer in wheelbase, longer in length. And I think Caddy is going to have to respond to that by kind of going away from the direction they've gone now with, you know, sportier sedans,
mm-hmm.
back to some of the big luxury, you know, again, luxury barges that we see on the, or have seen on the road from them in the past. I think that that's my gut feeling, is that people are going to want maybe not so much the crossover that's luxurious and feels good, or the, you know, the, even the pickup trucks, you know, that are luxurious and feels good on the road, but they're going to want, you know, more of the comfort and the style of the old classic sedan with, you know, modern elements, of course. It's going to have modern technology. It's going to have modern look. It's just going to be the size of those old vehicles. It's going to be like a, you know, rolling studio apartment, like you said. So what do you think? Do you have a gut feeling on this?
Yeah. I think it's honestly in many ways tied to the price of gas.
Mm-hmm.
So as we see the cost of energy lowering, or you know, as we see that spiking or falling, then we kind of see a correlation with the kind of cars people want to buy.
Yeah, sure. All these outside factors that influence what we buy,
mm-hmm.
It seems like almost overnight, doesn't it, the way that it fluctuates?
The way that it feels, yeah. It's weird how quickly the response occurs. But, yeah, I think so. And personally, I don't have anything against smaller cars. I like the bigger ones, because if you're on a road trip or something, or you need to haul something, you know, is a Mini the right choice?
So yeah, I guess you're
right. So I'm saying it's just because of what I like to do with a vehicle.
Yeah.
They're, you know, bigger cars are just better for me. But...
Oh, wait. We can't go on right now. We gotta talk about one more quick thing.
What's that?
Well, two things, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
We mentioned earlier that we think that maybe station wagons are making a comeback. So
yeah.
Let's hope that that happens.
That
manufacturers come out with more station wagon designs. And we haven't given Dylan his nickname yet.
Ooh,
I'm hoping.
Good
that
save.
Let's talk about this. Dylan the Chopper, because I hope he chops out a lot of that rambling that I had somewhere in the middle there. And this becomes a shorter podcast that our listeners will never know about then, because he's done his job, right? He's cut it down.
That's true.
Well,
he's like the invisible hand of our
unless
show.
They still hear it and say, my God, how long did he talk? Because... the Chopper, or how about
Chopper?
Doesn't relate to today's topic though.
Dylan Big Block Fagan.
I like it.
Well, we'll see. And if you have any suggestions for Dylan's nickname for this episode, let us know. Longtime listeners, you know, this is the part of the show where Scott and I end up going off the air to continue looking at this stuff. I'm going to look up prices for station wagons. I'm not going to buy one, I think. I'm just going to look a window shop.
Yeah, see if there's any... I'm going to look around on Craigslist and see if there's any Fleetwood 75s for sale.
Oh, this is going to be like the go-kart thing all over
again.
Yeah,
I know. There's absolutely no room for this thing. I could even park it diagonally in my garage. It's a funny thought, isn't it?
Yeah, hopefully it comes with a portable garage. But... you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. In the meantime, we're CarStuffHSW on both of those. You can check out the episodes we mentioned previously on our website, carstuffshow.com, where we have every audio episode we've ever produced. And stay tuned. We will be back next week. I don't want to spoil it too much, but we'll be back next week with a little bit of a different story. Another listener suggestion about a disaster at sea.
All right, sounds good. I'm on the edge of my seat right now, Ben.
Right.
I even know what it is, but I'm on the edge of my seat.
What did you used to say? You pay for the whole seat, but you only need the edge?
Yeah, that's right. That's the old monster truck ads from radio, remember?
Yeah, yes. And Monster Jam's coming to Atlanta in March.
It is. It'll be here soon.
Yeah.
You know what? That's the final event for the Phillips Arena. Is that right? Or the Georgia Dome, which is it? I can't remember.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's the final thing. It's going to be like the last thing before they completely tear it down.
I hope we get to go.
Yeah.
Provided we survive next week's vicarious maritime disaster. And if you have a suggestion for our super producer's nicknames, or if you have some strong opinions on land yachts, or just a fond memory of the best land yacht you ever drove.
Or you can tell me if they're going to tear down the Georgia Dome or Phillips Arena. I don't remember which one it is.
Because we don't want you to accidentally show up there and then be caught in the demolition.
Well, they're side by side. Come on. Someone could make that mistake.
Well, so set us straight on that one. And if you're not given to the social media rigmarole, no worries. You can directly contact us via email. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com. And I really want that answer.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.